This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is baseball legend Mickey Mantle. He played with the New York Yankees for his entire Major League career, which lasted from 1951 to 68. Mantle's early life is the kind of story that inspires many small-town boys to try for the Major Leagues. He grew up in Commerce, Oklahoma, was brought to the big city at the age of 19, and quickly became the talk of the town. Mickey Mantle developed into one of the greatest hitters of his time. He was voted into the Hall of Fame in 1974. Mickey Mantle's personal life didn't always measure up to his clean-cut American hero image. He drank a lot and spent very little time with his wife and children, even during the off-season. Throughout most of his baseball career, Mantle played with pain because of early leg injuries which never healed well. And he was haunted by the fear he'd die young, like the men in his family who were killed by Hodgkin's disease before reaching age 40. Now at the age of 54, Mickey Mantle is highly paid for his public relations work with an Atlantic City gambling casino. The job got him briefly banned from baseball because of its connection to gambling. Mantle has written a new autobiography. It's titled The Mick. Mickey Mantle's father was a miner who didn't want his son to follow in his footsteps. He always hoped Mickey would play professional baseball.
My dad named me before I was born after a baseball player. His idol was Mickey Cochran. And so he named me Mickey before I was born, and he said he used to just live for baseball, and he lived for the day that I would be a professional baseball player. And fortunately, I liked baseball, so every day he worked in the lead and zinc mines. When he would come home from work, he would hit me baseball, hit me fly balls and grounders, and then he would take tennis balls and pitch to me. He pitched to me right-handed, and his dad, my grandfather, would pitch to me left-handed. They made a switch hitter out of me. And he used to tell me, I didn't like to hit left-handed at first because I couldn't hit as good as I could right-handed. So he said, no, son, you got to keep hitting left-handed because someday, if you go to the major leagues, they're going to have two platooning. And the year that I joined the Yankees, 1951, is when Casey Stengel started having left-handed hitters hit against right-handed pitchers and right-handed hitters hit against left-handed pitchers. So he knew what he was talking about. He was before his time, really.
You were one of the few people of that time who skipped from a Class C minor league right up into the major league team. What was it like when you were kind of suddenly there playing with the Yankees and a lot of the people whose careers you'd been following were your teammates? Were you in awe of them? Were you able to relate to them easily?
Well, I was the first time I ever, after the job, that was in 1949, Tom Greenwade signed me when I graduated out of high school, and I went to Independence, Kansas, Class D, in the KOM League, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Missouri. The next year, I went to Joplin, Missouri, which is Class C, and I had a real good year at Joplin. I was making $225 a month at Joplin, and at the end of the year, the Yankees was fighting it out with Red Sox, I think, to get in the World Series, and they come through St. Louis, Missouri on a western swing. And at the end of the Joplin season, they had me to go up to St. Louis and meet the Yankees and go with them to Chicago and then back to New York. And that was the first time I ever saw Yankee Stadium. I think probably the biggest crowd I'd ever played before was like 500 or 600 people at Joplin. And the first time I went in Yankee Stadium, they had 68,000 people there. That's almost more people than I thought was in the state of Oklahoma. So it was a pretty big jump for me, and I didn't play there that year. It was just, get the feel of it. Then the next year, when the Yankees went to spring training in Phoenix, Arizona, they invited me to go there because I'd had a really good year, and I was a rookie. And that's when I started, hitting a lot of home runs, right-handed and left-handed. And Casey Stengel started saying that I was a phenom, and I was going to be the next Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and Joe DiMaggio all rolled into one. And so I stayed with the Yankees up until we opened the season, and I hadn't signed a contract yet. And Casey took me back and introduced me to George Weiss and Dan Topping and Dale Webb and told them he'd like to keep me. And so they kept me. I signed up a contract. I was 19 years old, and I was playing with the Yankees.
You say in your book that the rookies in those days were really treated like gophers. What did you have to do, and were you initiated in any way, tested out to see if you were acceptable to the veterans on the team?
Yeah, my first year when we got back to New York, I roomed with Hank Bauer and Johnny Hopp, and they were both veterans and old tough veterans, you know, and I was their rookie. Like, if we was after the game in a clubhouse, if one of them wanted a beer, they'd say, hey, rookie, go get me a beer. You know, I have to go get them a beer. And then when we get back to the we didn't stay in a hotel. We had an apartment over the stage delicatessen, and if one of them wanted a salami sandwich or something like that, I had to run downstairs and get it. But that's the way they used to treat rookies. They don't do that anymore, but that's the way they treated rookies then.
Why isn't it then now?
Well, the rookies come up nowadays, they're millionaires, you know. I mean, when you get out of college, if you're any good at all, you can sign a contract for $1 million for 20 years or something. So the rookies, that stopped about the time I became a veteran. The rookies that started coming up were like Joe Pepitone and Cleet Boyer and those kind of guys that were making as much money as the veterans then. So there wasn't any rookies anymore.
Did anything give you trouble when you first got to New York after having grown up in a small town in Oklahoma?
Well, yeah, a lot of things. First of all, I wasn't Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio all rolled into one like they said I was going to be, and the people started booing me, you know. In fact, I got sent back to the minor leagues my first year. I started striking out a lot. I'd lost all my confidence. Casey had to take me out of a game in Boston because I struck out 5 straight times in a doubleheader. He took me out of the last game, and when we got to Detroit on the next trip, he sent me back down to the minor leagues, and I went like 1 for 25. That's one hit and 25 times at bat in Kansas City, which is AAA. And I'd really lost my confidence by then, so then I called my dad down in the mines. I said, Dad, I don't think I can play anymore baseball. I'm down at Kansas City. I can't even hit here. He said, where you at? And I said, the Aladdin Hotel. And he said, well, I'll be right there. And he drove all the way from Oklahoma up to Kansas City. And I thought he was coming up to be sympathetic with me, to pat me on the back and say, hang in there, kid, or something like that. When he came in the room, he just threw my suitcase on a bed and started throwing clothes in it. And I said, what's the matter? And he says, well, I thought I raised a man. He said, you're nothing but a coward. He said, you don't even have any guts. He said, I'm going to pack your things. You can come back to Oklahoma with me and work in the mines the rest of your life like I did. And I said, well, it took me about 30 minutes to talk him into giving me another chance, you know. And then afterwards, I started hitting again, and the rest of it's history.
Why do you think you fell into that hitting slump when you first joined the Yankees? Was it the difficulty of facing major league pitchers, which you weren't used to?
Probably. I never had hit major league pitchers before. They find out something. If one of them happens to throw a fastball high and inside where you can't hit it, and they find out you can't hit it, they have a little, they're like, they stick together, you know. The word gets around fast. This pitch mantle, high fastballs on the inside of the part of the plate when he's hitting left-handed, and he can't touch you. And so that it gets around. You got to learn to lay off of it.
So you got called up in August of that same season to rejoin the Yankees. What was the rest of that season like for you?
When I went back to the Yankees, I was, like I said, I had gained my confidence back, and the rest of the season was pretty good. We got in the World Series that year. In the second game of the World Series that year is when I hurt my leg. I was playing right field. Joe DiMaggio was playing center field. Willie Mays hit a pop fly in the second game. I was running over to try to catch it in right center. When I got there, Joe DiMaggio was already standing under it, and he said, I got it. When I tried to stop, I stepped on a rubber head of a drain pipe, and it tore my knee up. I had to go to my dad was at the series that year, and he took me to the hospital the next morning. When I got out of the cab, I put my arm around his shoulder to jump out of the cab, and all of my weight made him collapse on the sidewalk. I didn't even know he was sick at that time, but they put him and me both in the hospital. We watched the rest of the series from the same hospital room, and that's when they found out that he had Hodgkin's disease. They operated on my leg and then told me that they couldn't do much for him. So when we got home that winter, I took him to Mayo's Clinic, and that's when we found out he had Hodgkin's disease, and he was incurable.
And your leg didn't heal very well either.
Well, I didn't do the exercise. They gave me in those days, it wasn't like arthroscopic surgery. You know, you had to have your leg cut out, and then they put a cast on it for like 6 weeks or 2 or 3 months. I don't know how long. It was a long time. Anyway, they gave me exercises to do when I took the cast off, and I didn't do them. I just thought, you know, I was young, and I figured it'd just come back anyway, but it didn't happen to do that. If I would have taken care of it, I'd have been a lot better off.
You played in pain for a good deal of your career. Was it typical for baseball players to be in as much pain as you must have been in because of that leg and because of subsequent injuries?
No, it was, you know, it was out of the ordinary, really. And I think probably exaggerated a little bit all the pain that I played in. I had to wrap my leg with about a 10-foot bandage. It was like a gauze on one side and rubber on the outside. And I would tape it from like my hip all the way down to my ankle, both of my legs, because I hurt the other leg too after that. And it looked like it was worse than it was. I looked like a mummy when I was getting ready to play, and I got a lot of press where they said, poor Mickey, you know, he can't do this, he can't do that. But I wasn't hurting as bad as they thought I was, probably.
When it became clear that you were going to be a great home run hitter, would you always go for the home run when you were up at bat?
Well, I went for the home run. Every time I swung at a ball, I was trying to hit it as far as I could. That wasn't just when I became a home runner. I was always a home run hitter from the time I was a kid. So that's all I like. I love to see how far I could hit a ball.
You started getting a lot of strikeouts when your home run record started to really rise. Were you swinging at anything in an attempt to actually get something that
anybody that hits a lot of home runs is going to strike out a lot? Except Roger didn't strike out that much. Neither did Joe DiMaggio or Ted Williams. But most guys like Schmidt, myself. Babe Ruth, I broke Babe Ruth's strikeout record. When I struck out 1,710 times, and when I retired, I was the most. But Reggie Jackson now has gone past me, Willie Stargell. All the guys that strike out a lot are home run hitters. I mean, if you're going to hit the ball a long way, you have to swing hard. You can't be like Pete Rose and punch it to left and right and something like that. You know, you have to swing hard at it. And if you swing hard, you're going to strike out a lot.
When you thought you had a home run, would you stand there and –
No.
Watch it, or would you just start running just in case?
The Reggie trot, I didn't do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you
no.
didn't do that.
In fact, I never tipped my hat or did the high five or anything like that. It always embarrassed me, really, to see the opposing pitcher. I hated to look at the opposing pitcher because I knew how he must feel, because I knew how I felt when he struck me out. You know, he didn't jump up and down and wave his hands and tip his hat when he struck me out, so why should I do all that when I hit a home run off of him?
It was in 1961, I think, that you and Roger Maris were both trying to break the Babe Ruth record of 60 home runs in one season. How important was it for you to try to break that record?
Well, anybody that ever played baseball, especially a home run hitter, would love to break that record, 61 homers. I tried it once before in 1956. I hit 52 homers. And going into September, I was way ahead of Babe Ruth's home run record. It looked like I might do it that year. And then Roger came along in 61, and me and him both was way ahead of Babe Ruth's record. Going into the last month, I got sick. I had a real bad cold, and I took a shot from some quack doctor in New York somebody sent me to. And I had to have my hip lanced, and I missed the last couple of weeks. But Roger went ahead and broke it. And I think probably that's the greatest single feat I've ever seen in pro sports, was Roger hitting them home runs, because I know how hard it is to do. The public is not only the public, but the press and everybody else is following you everywhere you go. And Roger is not an outgoing guy. He was, he's really backward. He don't like a lot of press or anything like that. So I realized what a thing it was for him to do, to break that record. And, like, I wasn't there the last couple of weeks, but he had big splotches of hair coming out from his nerves, you know. So it was really hard for him to do it, and there should never be an asterisk by his record in the record book. He did something that I think was really hard to do.
The fans really rooted for him to break the record, but you say that once it was broken, they turned against him. And then they started giving you ovations. Can you explain the psychology that you think was motivating the
fans? I think probably the American public is always for the underdog, and they wanted me to break the record. If somebody was going to break Babe Ruth's record, they wanted it to be me, because I'd been there for all this long, you know, for a long time. Roger just came up, and the American public's like for the underdog all the time, and I was the underdog in that race. And when Roger finally did break the record, everybody started, up until that time, I'd been like the villain. You know, I'd taken Joe, or trying to take Joe DiMaggio's place and everything, and they'd been booing me all that time. And all of a sudden, Roger wins the home run contest. He hit 61 homers. They turned their wrath on Roger instead of me. And everywhere I went from then on, I was like the hero and Roger was the villain. So it really did help me a lot.
Did you learn to distrust fans because they were so fickle?
No, I learned right away that you can be a bum one day and a hero the next day. So you got to take them both. You know, if you strike out four times and they boo you, you got it coming. You know, but the next day you hit a home run with the bases loaded or get a single in the ninth inning and drive in the winning run, they forget about the four strikeouts. So I learned that early in life.
You had a temper, didn't you? Some of the times when you struck out.
Well, I struck out so much that I never did get used to it. You know, usually you get used to something like that. But I still can't stand, like, if I three-putt a green, it doesn't mean that much, but I can't stand it. I mean, I throw putters and throw drivers and everything. I'm just, when I struck out playing baseball, I used to hit the water coolers and throw bats and helmets and stuff like that. But it's just something in my makeup. I can't help.
Didn't you once smash a water cooler after you struck out?
I used to smash them all the time, yeah. Guys would always go down to the other end of the bat from the bat rack whenever I came back in after striking out. Casey used to get mad at me and he'd tell me, don't do that anymore. You know, I'm going to have to fine you and you're going to break your hand or something. And then in Baltimore, they didn't have water coolers. They had those big jugs of water that you buy and bring to the ballpark. And they used to, when I'd strike out in Baltimore, and they had good pitching down there, I used to strike out quite a bit. The fans would take out their hankies and yell at me, you know, go break the water cooler, you know, they yell and stuff like that. One day Casey told me, said, I'm going to have to fine you if you hit the water cooler or throw your bats or anything anymore. The American League's getting mad. You're making a fool out of yourself. You're going to break your hand. So the next night, I struck out again, and the fans were yelling and screaming, you know, and I couldn't stand it anymore. So instead of hitting something, I picked up the water jug and took it and threw it on the field and broke it out on the field. They fined me like $50 for breaking the water jug, and Casey fined me $100 for doing it. And there was a lot of times things like that happened.
So it was $150 worth of penalty, a discouragement against doing it again?
Yeah. It didn't mean that much, though. The 150, it was worth it to break the water cooler.
My guest is Mickey Mantle. What did you think of your hero status in America? I mean, you were a symbol for, you know, just about every person, especially boys growing up in New York, and then across the whole nation, you were a symbol, too. You were an American hero. You stood for baseball. You stood for, you know, what was good about the country. Was that a lot to live up to? Did it feel like you?
Well, yeah, you have to, you have to really watch yourself. I felt like I did anyway, and the Yankees always, you know, like I used to like to chew tobacco. And they made me quit chewing, or they asked me, they couldn't make you not do it, but they asked me don't chew tobacco because, you know, it don't look like a Yankee, and the kids now, they look up to you. If I was drinking, I would try to stay out of sight, you know. I never did smoke because I was afraid. I did do a Camel commercial one time, and I always wished I hadn't have because my dad didn't like for me to do commercials like that. I don't think he would have liked for me to do a beer commercial. I did one of those. I did a lot of things that I felt bad about later on, but at the time, it didn't seem that important.
Yeah, that same time that you were the national hero, you were really doing a lot of drinking, too, and I think you were famous for your carousing among baseball players.
I'm more famous for it now than I was then. A lot of people are surprised when they read that book because they didn't know I even drank. And when you read the book, it sounds like I was an alcoholic, but that's the farthest thing from the truth. It's just that the fun that I did have through my baseball career was when I was drinking. I mean, I guess my personality came in a bottle, for as I know, because the stories that I tell in that book are probably 15 or 20 things that happened over 18 years. And if you read the book, it sounds like I was an alcoholic. And that's another. If there is a moral to that book, it would be for little league kids or kids in high school or college, anybody, in fact, to take better care of their bodies because guys like Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Stan Musial, all the guys that are really good and their names are at the top of the list in the lifetime statistics are guys that took good care of themselves and played 20 years. I was over the hill at 34 and had to retire at 36, and it's probably because I didn't take as good a care of myself as I should have.
In Jim Boughton's book, Ball Four.
I don't talk about Boughton's book.
You don't talk
no.
about it? Well, let me just say this, that he reported a lot of things about your drinking and also appetite for women and desire to, like, see women through, looking through telescopes and stuff in hotel windows. Is that the kind of stuff that you think shouldn't be mentioned in print?
I've got some things in my book that probably shouldn't be mentioned, but they're in there, you know. And it's about me, though. It's not about somebody else.
My guest is Mickey Mantle, and he's written a new book about his life. It's called The Mick, and it's just been published by Doubleday. When you first signed with the Yankees, I think your salary was $5,400, and then you became one of the few players to make $100,000 during the period that you were playing. What do you think of salaries today? Do you think that they're inflated? Do you think that they're appropriate?
Well, people, everybody's making a lot more money than they used to. Johnny Carson, I think, gets $5 million a year salary. No telling how much he makes. But a lot of people are making a lot of money now, and baseball players spend a lot of time on TV. That's where all the money comes from. And if you really think about it, a baseball player spends about 3 hours a day on TV. So if really their salaries are a lot, you know. I mean, compared to what I made, Dave Winfield makes $1,500,000 a year for 20 years. $1,500,000 is more than I made with the Yankees in 18 years. So it sounds like a lot, but when you really think about it, everybody's making a lot more now.
Do you think that the ball players now should be doing more to see to it that that the older ball players have a better pension than they do?
You mean old-timers?
The retired players, yeah.
I think so. I'm an old-timer, and I'm retired. I haven't started taking my pension, but if I did, it would only be about $40,000 or $45,000 a year. What the players nowadays are going to get is unbelievable. I mean, if they get what they're asking for, part of the $1 billion TV pact, when they retire, the guys that are playing nowadays, when they retire, they can get over $100,000 or $150,000, $200,000. I don't know how much it's going to be. It's astronomical what they're going to be able to get when they retire. If they do put the old-timers in there, I'm for them. I mean, I'd like to see them help out. We have a lot of old-time ball players that are not making much money right now, and I do believe that they should be put into the pension fund, into the new stuff.
When did you know that it was time for you to retire?
I went to spring training in 1969. With the first 15 years with the Yankees, we won the pennant 13 times. And all of a sudden, Whitey Ford was gone, Billy Martin was gone, Yogi was gone. I was left. I was the youngest one of the bunch that was the good Yankees or the good teams. And all of a sudden, they were all gone. I got to where I couldn't run from home to first as fast as I used to. I couldn't score from second base. I couldn't go from first to third. And they moved me from the outfield into first base. All they had to do was just walk me, and we couldn't score. It was time. In 1968, I didn't have a good year. I didn't have a good year after 1964. And so I went to spring training, and I couldn't get in shape. My legs were hurting real bad. It just got to where I couldn't hardly run at all, and it was just time for me to retire.
One of the things you've done since retiring is work in Atlantic City with one of the hotels doing public relations work. And Bowie Kuhn had said that if you were involved with any kind of gambling establishment, then you were disowned basically from baseball. And that was recently reversed. What did you think of that? Did you think that was hypocritical?
Well, I knew that I was going to be banned if I took the job with the Claridge. Billy Kuhn was the commissioner, and he had Lee McPhail to call me and tell me if I took the job with the Claridge, I was going to be banned from baseball because he had banned Willie Mays before. And all I was doing in baseball was going to spring training as a coach, a batting instructor for the Yankees 2 weeks out of the year. Ever since I retired from baseball back in 1969, and all it was like a 2 week vacation. I wasn't doing anything really in baseball anyway, so it didn't really bother me that much being banned from baseball, except the fact that you don't want to be banned from anything, you know. I mean, I never did understand why I was banned. I knew I wasn't like standing on the street saying, come in and shoot craps or play blackjack or something like that. So I was glad that Commissioner Uberoff reinstated me not too long ago, and it took a big load off my shoulders.
You're the first man in your family to have lived past 40. Other men in your family have died of Hodgkin's disease. Has the fear that could have happened to you, did that fear, do you think, affect the way you lived your life in your earlier years?
I think probably deep down in the back of my mind, I always felt like I was probably just going to make it to about 40, and I have a feeling that might be the reason that I lived it up like I did. Wondering, you know, or thinking that I might not live that long. But since then, you know, I never think about it anymore, except the other day I come up with a real bad headache, and I had two lumps on the side of my throat, and I called Roger Maris. He has lymphoma now, and I called him and was talking to him about it, and he said that's the way his started. And, of course, with my history, my family history, it really did worry me a lot, and it still does. You know, I still have the headache. I can't get rid of the headache, but I've been to a couple of doctors, and I've had a couple of CAT scans, and they tell me there's nothing to worry about, so I'm just taking their word for it.
That's good. How do you think you'd feel if you were coming up now? Because I think baseball has changed in many ways since the time that you were playing. Do you think that you'd enjoy it as much, or are there aspects about the way the sport's played now that you don't like as much?
Well, I don't like the it doesn't seem to me like the players have the allegiance to their team that they used to have, and it's probably because they're making – I'd love to make the money they're making. I get a kick out of people always asking me nowadays, say, could you play for Steinbrenner? Well, of course I could play. I'd love to play for Steinbrenner. I'd be making about $2 million a year, you know, and probably have a 20-year contract, so it'd be great. You'd be set for the rest of your life. But accordingly, I'd rather be playing. I would rather have played when I did, because I love the guys I play with. The guys nowadays don't seem like they're that close together. Whenever I played, Billy Martin, Hank Byer, Whitey Ford, Yogi Berra, Allie Reynolds, all those guys were like brothers to me. I mean, we spent 8 months together. Today, they just come to the ballpark, they play the game, and they leave. I don't think they get to know each other. Probably four or five of them might be real close, but as a team, I don't think they are.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you.
That was Mickey Mantle, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Mickey Mantle has written an autobiography. It's titled The Mick, published by Doubleday. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Joyce Lieberman and Mark Moss. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.